Hello, bonjour, and welcome to the fifth official podcast of the Ottawa Law Review. We're your hosts, Hardy and Christy, and today we're pleased to bring you a special edition of the podcast. It's a look at the UOttawa Public Law Center's Speaker Series event entitled Our Bags Are Packed, Supreme Court of Canada Fall Preview, where five experts previewed five Supreme Court cases to watch in the fall session. The event is the first in a two-part series on upcoming SCC cases, the second of which will focus on civil law and will be held on October 30th, 2019. Okay, let's get into this.
Nous sommes enchantés. We're so thrilled to be joined by Professors Vanessa McDonnell and Kyle Kirkup, moderators at the Speaker Series event, who have kindly agreed to be our legal guides as we navigate the complex issues that arise in these five interesting cases. Professor Vanessa McDonnell is an associate professor here at the Faculty of Law, Common Law Section, and co-director of the newly established UOttawa Public Law Center. She is an expert in, among other things, constitutional law and theory, criminal law, and the law of evidence.
Professor Kyle Kirkup is an assistant professor at the University of Ottawa. His research explores the role of constitutional law, criminal law, and family law in regulating contemporary norms of gender identity and sexuality. He also serves as one of the faculty advisors of the Ottawa Law Review. Both of our professors previously clerked at the Supreme Court of Canada and are frequent media commentators on pressing legal issues. Welcome and thank you both for joining us today.
Morning.
Thank you.
Should we start? Alors, pour la première fois le mois dernier, la Cour suprême s'est rendue à Winnipeg pour entendre deux appels. But maybe even more novel than that is that the federal court actually subtweeted the Supreme Court on Twitter. Voici Darius Bosset, avocat au cabinet Juris Power et un de nos experts de la conférence qui le raconte.
Je veux noter quand même que la Cour d'appel fédérale là, a mis un tweet au cours de l'été où elle dit, là je vais citer, « Saviez-vous que la Cour d'appel fédérale est probablement celle qui voyage le plus parmi les cours d'appel à l'échelle mondiale? Lors de la dernière année, la Cour a tenu des séances dans 14 villes différentes à travers le pays et disposé ce faisant de plus de 350 litiges. » Donc c'était comme un humble brag, là, un genre.
Now, putting aside the Twitter shade, or Twitter penumbra for you lawyer types, the Supreme Court had quite the field trip in Manitoba. They visited a high school, a law school, and they heard two cases, a French language rights case and a criminal law case. The criminal law case, called RVKGK, has a really straightforward question at its center, so we're going to start there. As a quick background, in 2016, the Supreme Court interpreted the Charter Section 11B right to be tried within a reasonable time to mean that courts have approximately 18 months, simplifying some complicated math about who causes delays, to resolve someone's criminal offense. So the straightforward question that KGK raises is basically this. Should the time it takes for a judge to write her decision be included in this constitutionally mandated countdown? And my question to you, professors, isn't asking judges to resolve this question kind of like letting a law student decide whether they should be docked a grade mark for handing in their paper late?
So I guess we can think about this case as being one of the cases that follows logically from the Jordan case. So Jordan was a real change in how courts adjudicate questions of constitutional delay. And so I think this is, you can view this as being a bit of a refinement of Jordan. So, and an attempt to bring some additional clarity to what those dates actually mean. And in some respects, I think having chosen drop dead dates effectively by setting these very clear limits, subject, of course, to some discretion, it was inevitable that additional questions would arise, additional hypotheticals or scenarios would arise that would challenge the establishment of those fixed periods. And so I think this is probably predictable and probably also actually, you know, a good question for judges to be asking themselves so that they, judges understand the work that they do as being part and parcel of thinking about constitutional delay and the impact that that can have on accused persons.
And Darius had a great summary of the two sides of this case. Voici Darius qui résume les intérêts des différentes parties impliquées.
Les appelants disent évidemment que oui, ça devrait compter, puis que si la Cour met tellement de temps et que ça excède le plafond de 30 mois, la cause devrait être rejetée. Et puis les intimés, eux, proposent plutôt un critère là, qui découle d'une autre affaire, l'affaire Rahi. Puis le test, le critère, ça serait de dire comme est-ce que le délai est honteux, démesuré et déraisonnable.
So, jumping off of your answer to my question, I guess, is it fair to say that the court is being asked to either double down on Jordan, which had monumental impacts on the way that criminal justice is delivered in Canada, or basically kind of craft a new approach that might lead to a potential backslide in terms of some of the access to justice gains that we've seen since that decision?
So I would say that the legacy of Jordan is quite fraught. I think some people will say this is a strong endorsement of the rights of the accused to not be waiting often in very difficult conditions of confinement as they await a trial. And then on the other hand, people will say well, it's done all kinds of weird and wonderful things to what Crown actors are doing in the system, right? How they're prioritizing cases, which cases are actually getting to trial. So I think that this is the logical extension of Jordan in some ways, a bit of a refinement. And I think one of the questions that the court has to grapple with is, from the accused person's perspective, do they really... You know, is it meaningful that the reason for the delay is that the judge is sitting behind her computer screen working, or does that still mean that, you know, they could be in pretty bad conditions of confinement waiting for a decision and a disposition in the case?
Well, I guess however KGK is decided, it will definitely have wide-ranging impacts on the criminal justice system.
Retournons aux appels entendus à Winnipeg. Darius a beaucoup parlé de la cause concernant l'article 23 de la Charte, portant sur le droit à l'instruction dans la langue de la minorité. D'un côté, on a le Conseil scolaire francophone de la Colombie-Britannique qui revendique plus de fonds pour les écoles francophones. Et de l'autre, on a la province de la Colombie-Britannique qui a répliqué qu'il n'y avait pas d'assez d'étudiants pour justifier ces dépenses.
So really, one of the issues here is that a costs argument is being used to limit a charter right, which effectively means that we're looking at a really basic constitutional law 101 question. How should we interpret Section 1 of the Charter? Section 1, as its place in the Constitution might suggest, is obviously really important. But before I embarrass myself by constitution-splaining Section 1 to our two con law profs, can one of you explain why this case about French language schools in BC has the potential to have ripple effects on nearly every other constitutionally protected right?
So I think that like sometimes the straightforward negative liberty cases, so the cases where someone says there's a bad law, I want to challenge it constitutionally, and I want the court to get out the constitutional wrecking ball and get rid of the bad provision, those are in some ways easier for the court to deal with, right? Because they don't usually attach with cost consequences, right? They don't cost money for the court to achieve its goal. And I think the second that you add money into the equation, courts start to get a little bit worried about the normative limits of their role, right? Is this the kind of question that is better left to the legislature, right? Are judges the best positioned actors to make decisions about cost consequences? And so it's, you know, quite predictable, I think, in a case like this to say, there's an open question, I think, about whether French language rights in British Columbia, where there's a smaller French-speaking population, are going to be exactly the same as they would be in, say, the city of Ottawa, where we have a large Francophone population. So I think this is an ongoing tension. And any time that there is the specter of cost raised, you can see courts really grappling with the limits or the appropriate role that they ought to play in interpreting constitutional rights.
And Darius Bossé, our expert yesterday, really pinpointed that lower courts seem to be really sympathetic, as you say, to this the government's cost concerns. And he discussed why the lower court's reasoning might be so potentially problematic in this case.
Les tribunaux inférieurs ont attribué un poids important à l'idée de sauver des coûts. Donc en anglais, l'expression utilisé par le gouvernement, c'est le « fair and rational allocation of limited public funds ». Puis les tribunaux ont jugé que cet objectif-là était effectivement un objectif réel et urgent qui permet de ensuite justifier des atteintes à l'article 23 de la Charte. Ça soulève plusieurs problèmes. D'abord parce que dans le contexte de l'article 23, il y a déjà toute une analyse des coûts qui se fait à l'intérieur de l'article 23. Donc là, en invoquant à nouveau les coûts à l'article 1er, on est essentiellement en train de doubler le poids qu'on va accorder à cette considération-là.
Professor McDonnell, before we move on, you had an excellent question during the Q&A yesterday asking about the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs.
Oui, je voulais savoir un petit peu plus de Darius sur le sujet de l'intervenant, l'Assemblée de Manitoba Chiefs, pourquoi ils ont intervenu et la signification de cette cause-ci pour les Premières Nations.
And as a disclaimer, this part of the recording is a little shoddy because it was done during the Q&A session, so apologies for the quality.
Oui, ça c'est intéressant, ça a piqué la curiosité de beaucoup de gens d'ailleurs. Mais comme je l'ai dit plus tôt, la Cour, les tribunaux inférieurs ont accordé beaucoup de poids au coût. Donc l'idée de sauver de l'argent, ça peut être utilisé pour justifier justement les atteintes aux droits de la Charte. Ça, c'est certainement quelque chose qui a inquiété l'Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs. Mais l'autre chose aussi, ça j'ai pas eu le temps d'en discuter, mais la juge met beaucoup d'accent sur le caractère inévitable de l'assimilation dans certaines régions. Puis elle dit essentiellement que bon, puisque l'assimilation est inévitable dans certaines régions, ce fait-là est pertinent pour limiter justement le droit lui vise à contrer l'assimilation. Et puis le mémoire des Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs, c'est vraiment intéressant. Ils disent qu'on connaît très bien les Premières Nations, les effets négatifs de l'assimilation. Et donc, si les tribunaux traitent l'assimilation de cette façon-là, dans le cadre de l'article 1er, c'est terrible pour tout le monde.
So definitely some really important implications across the board when this decision will be released. Should we move on to the next case?
Yeah. So here's a potential question for first years wading through intro to contract law. How do these three things connect? One, the incredibly lawyer speak term, the competence principle. Two, excessive filing fees in the Netherlands. And three, the access to justice implications of your decision to order a delivery poke bowl. The answer would definitely involve the Supreme Court of Canada's upcoming hearing on a case called Uber v. Heller. And yes, it's that Uber. The case, like similar types of litigation across the world involving the ride-sharing service, targets Uber's crafty terms of service that, one, attempt to exempt drivers from otherwise applicable employment laws, and two, force drivers and consumers to go to the tech giant's home turf, in this case, the Netherlands, to seek relief. Courts in Canada are being asked, basically, is this fair? The Faculty of Law's very own professor, Marina Pavlovic, is intervening in this case. And yesterday, during the event, she pointed out the very real access to justice issues inherent to filing a claim halfway across the world.
The cost of that MedArb process is $14,500 just to start the process, the filing fees. That doesn't include the cost of a mediator, the cost of an arbitrator, legal fees, premises, etc. Uber drivers like Mr. Heller earn between $20,000 and $30,000 annually before taxes and all the other things that they have to pay. So the cost of filing a complaint is more than half of what they actually annually bring in. And that's why class actions are really only meaningful remedies for these kinds of things, because there is really power in numbers, right? Each individual driver would have a really hard time challenging Uber in the Netherlands for this alleged breach of the Employment Standards Act.
So this case is really complicated. There are over a dozen interveners trying to sort it out. But it's even more complicated because the Supreme Court doesn't really know what to do with the internet, right? Or to put it more gently, the case law is still evolving alongside the rapidly evolving social context. In fact, the Ontario Superior Court, who first heard this case, and the Court of Appeal, who heard the appeal, came to wildly different decisions on how to deal with the validity of the arbitration clause. Are we asking too much of very smart, but let's face it, pretty out-of-touch jurists to put themselves in the shoes of the everyday internet user?
So I think that the job for the lawyers in this case that are arguing on behalf of Mr. Heller is to say, actually, this is a fairly straightforward case. This is someone who's doing work, driving an Uber in Ontario. Of course, Ontario standards of employment ought to apply in this circumstance, right? So I think their job is to try to say, to demystify this idea that you can simply arbitrate your way out and use end-user licensing agreements to get out of just basic protections that are supposed to be available to people when they do work in Ontario, right? So I think the job of the lawyers here is to maybe say, you know, the prospect of the internet is a bit of a red herring.
The fact that the justices are wrestling with modern problems also leads to a lot of elasticity and unpredictability in the court's decisions about the internet. Professor Pavlovic summed up a string of recent cases about the internet, like Duez and Tellus, where justices like Gascon and Moldaver really substantively changed their minds about how they think about the fundamental issues at stake here.
In 2019, which was this year, we had Tellus versus Wellman, which was a domestic case involving arbitration. The sides have flipped. So Justice Gascon sort of moved sides and went from against people to sort of for corporations. And so here was the power play that we had. And so here is what we are going to be looking for in this case. So we're 4-4. Justice Gascon has retired. It is on Justice Kazirer, but I also think there's a question mark about Justice Moldaver, and here is why. In paragraph 85 of the Tellus decision, he says, in my view, arguments over any potential unfairness resulting from the enforcement of arbitration clauses contained in standard form contracts are better dealt with directly through the doctrine of unconscionability, like the Ontario Court of Appeal did in Uber versus Heller.
And I guess unlike our American counterparts, it can be really hard to predict what a Canadian Supreme Court justice is going to say. Professor Pavlovic did ask us to hedge our bets here. Either of you want to risk an opinion about which way this case will go?
Well, maybe I can just say something a little bit more general, which is, look, this is the reason that we like doing these sessions, that it can be really interesting to get an expert to come in and offer a take on an important case that's coming to the court. And Professor Pavlovic has been very involved in these cases that have gone to the Supreme Court in recent years. And this is what court watchers live for, right? Is that anticipation to try to figure out, which judge is likely to decide in what way. And I think you're quite right that the Canadian Supreme Court is different than its U.S. counterpart, and that it can be more difficult to predict the way that individual judges will decide cases. I think in this particular case, the speculation was an informed one. And so I'm on Team Pavlovic on this one for no other reason than that she's the expert.
And just to make a pitch, if you love court watching and you want to get in on it, there's fantasycourts.ca, which is a former Ottawa Law Review editor, I believe in chief, Tom Slade, who created Fantasy Courts, where you can basically go online and vote in upcoming cases about what judges are likely to do. You don't win any money. I think that would be illegal, but it's still a fun thing to watch and participate in.
Excellent. A good recommendation. But whatever else might be at stake here, isn't there something satisfying about nailing Uber with $400 million in damages for trying to subvert labor codes? Let's call payback for surge pricing.
But moving swiftly along, our next case, Joanne Fraser and the Attorney General. So this case is incredibly frustrating. Joanne Fraser is one of the many women applicants who are retired RCMP officers. As busy parents, they took advantage of a job sharing program to temporarily reduce their hours. To be clear, they didn't do this just on a whim. They did this to raise their kids. Now, all these years later, the RCMP pension plan is refusing to allow them to buy back their job sharing years for pensionable purposes. Despite, and here's the really infuriating part, this being an option available to other pension holders, most notably men, even when they were on disciplinary leave.
The legal question here, again, a case that will very likely become part of a future Con Law 101 syllabus, is how should we interpret Section 15 of the Charter that guarantees equality rights under the law? And more specifically, how should we apply it in cases of adverse effect discrimination? That's basically discrimination where a law, policy, or regulation appears non-discriminatory on its face, but creates discriminatory effects. In this case, the policy that said job-sharing years cannot be bought back disproportionately punished women.
And as U Ottawa Law professor Martha Jackman pointed out in her presentation on this case, the Federal Court of Appeal is engaged in some really old-school reasoning about what constitutes discrimination under the law.
Ce que la Cour a conclu, c'est que s'il y avait une distinction, cette distinction était en fonction du choix que les appelantes avaient fait de partager un poste plutôt que de prendre un congé sans solde. Donc, d'après la Cour, la distinction, c'était vraiment pas une distinction fondée sur le sexe ni la situation parentale, mais plutôt une distinction fondée sur le choix. Est-ce que je travaille à temps complet, je travaille à mi-temps, je travaille, je prends un congé sans solde. Et d'après la Cour, si on voulait accéder au même régime de pension, tout ce qu'on avait à faire, c'était de soit de travailler à temps complet ou d'aller en congé sans solde.
Et comme professeur Jackman soutient, ce raisonnement ressemble étrangement à Bliss, une affaire notoire des années 1970.
Dans le cas de l'affaire Bliss, vous vous souvenez encore peut-être, Mme Bliss, elle, n'avait pas le même accès aux prestations d'assurance chômage puisqu'elle était enceinte. La Cour suprême a conclu, et ça évidemment avant l'adoption de la charte, désolée, la distinction n'était pas entre les femmes et les autres, c'était une distinction entre les personnes enceintes qui voulaient prendre congé et les autres. Et s'il y avait un désavantage, c'était créé par la nature et le bon Dieu.
Professor Jackman later made the incredibly compelling and equally depressing point that so, so, so few women identifying claimants have successfully used Section 15. Can either of you speak to this? Was the charter written poorly, or are judges simply really bad at understanding systemic discrimination?
I think you can just read the Section 15 cases and realize that the court really has an impoverished understanding of substantive equality, right? Every 5 to 10 years, the Supreme Court comes out with a new test, right? So you can tell a story about Andrews being potentially this high water mark for substantive equality. Then a series of divisions in the 90s where the members of the court were disagreeing about the approach to take. There's then this attempt, this kind of magnus opus attempt to improve and synthesize what was going on in law. And then very quickly, the court abandons that approach in CAP and then refines it in Quebec versus A. All that's to say, a series of cases where the judges can't even decide on what the test is. And when that happens, I think it's unsurprising that you see a lot more action happening under Section 7, right? Why is it that a case like Bedford or Carter ultimately get decided on Section 7 grounds, right, like life, liberty, security of the person, rather than what would seem to be their natural home, which would be an equality rights analysis?
And I would agree with Professor Kirkup that this, the uncertainty and the relative kind of lack of perceived lack of potential of Section 15 arguments has undoubtedly had an impact on litigation strategy. And so in many ways, I think we see folks talking about litigants abandoning Section 15 arguments or raising them, but as sort of backup arguments or secondary arguments, not because there aren't significant equality issues at stake in the cases, but because of a perception that the chances of success are better under other sections of the Charter.
Speaking of discrimination, let's move on and talk about the reference case regarding the Genetic Non-Discrimination Act, also called the GNDA. Now, this case, as UOttawa Professor YY Chen made incredibly clear, is not really about genetic discrimination. Rather, it's about the power of the federal government to enact criminal laws. Some of the provisions of the GNDA criminalize genetic discrimination, which the GNDA defines as treating people differently because of what their DNA might reveal about their health. The GNDA further prohibits anyone from requiring someone to undergo a genetic test as a condition of providing them goods or services or otherwise entering into a contract.
There's really one basic question here. Can the federal parliament do this? Regulation of public health through the criminal law has been allowed by the SEC in limited cases before, but for their part, the Quebec Court of Appeal, the lower court here, seems skeptical. Professor Chen explains.
And specifically, the challenged provisions are said to promote public health by tackling the harms associated with people's insecurity around how their genetic information may be used. Quebec Court of Appeal, however, found there's no criminal purpose here. Right. Sections 1 through 7 of the GNDA do not target particular evil within the meaning of criminal law, according to the court. The purported harm to health in this case requires us to accept two propositions. Right? Not only that genetic information insecurity would create a chill and deter people from accessing genetic testing, but also that failure to undergo such tests would endanger a person's health.
So before we ask Professors Kirkup and McDonnell to weigh in here, I'd like to explain the major twist in this case. The federal government, represented here by the Attorney General, doesn't itself think that the law is constitutional. Professors, what is going on here?
So that goes back to the history, the lineage of the legislation. So it starts in the Senate. It's basically also a backbench revolt in some ways. The cabinet in the House of Commons doesn't support the bill. It manages to squeak through the House of Commons, through the Senate, and receive royal assent. So we have this very bizarre situation where the Attorney General of Canada, who would typically defend the constitutional validity of the act, is basically saying, yeah, we agree with the provinces. This is provincial sphere of jurisdiction. This is clearly health rather than criminal law.
Given that the federal government is kind of sabotaging its own case, what does this mean for the application of public health as a justification for criminal law?
Yeah, so it's a really challenging question, right? And probably the leading decision in this area is the assisted reproduction case from, I believe, 2011, where it's a 4-4 split on this issue. There's basically the Chief Justice who says it takes a more contextual approach to what constitutes criminal law, a slightly more expansive approach potentially, anytime that the Parliament is trying to target some evil, whereas Justice Labelle and Justice Deschamps articulating a more provincial rights perspective, undoubtedly affected by the fact that they're two Quebec jurists, and saying that, in fact, this is not valid exercise of federal power here, right? So you have a 4-4 split, and to complicate the matters further, the only judge who will have heard both cases is Justice Abella, because we've had such a change in terms of the personalities, the judges that are currently on the court. So very difficult to predict how this one will go, but it will have enormous implications for the way that we regulate health and criminal law and the various intersections between the two.
It's definitely a strange political situation. Speaking of, our final case, and another reference to the Supreme Court of Canada, this time by way of the lovely Prairie Province of Saskatchewan.
The context here is so crucial, as Professor Natalie Shadifull points out. The world is on fire, yet our governments are quibbling over jurisdiction. She describes here how this case comes down to an age-old Section 91-92 debate. How do you characterize each order of government's responsibility under the Constitution?
In terms of key takeaways and what's going to be really at the heart of the litigation at the Supreme Court, it's going to be the characterization, this question of just how far can, in the pith and substance analysis and the characterization, can we go in assigning this matter to the federal government? And I think a very, very important discussion that's going to undoubtedly take place at the Supreme Court is the idea of this tension that we heard throughout the arguments about the potential for displacing provincial power and the extent to which there is space, of course, not for concurrent jurisdiction, but concurrent application of laws. And there's really strong language, particularly in the Ontario Court of Appeal majority decision, that this law would not restrict the provinces from doing virtually anything on greenhouse gas emissions. They still have ample constitutional space for doing lots of things at the provincial level, as long as they meet the minimum pricing standard.
So there's a lot in there, but fortunately we have two con law professors with us. Two questions. One, for those unfamiliar, what is pith and substance? Because that might be a term that jumps off the page. Secondly, what jurisdiction is the federal government asserting here, and why does Saskatchewan and Ontario, who also intervened, so strongly oppose?
So I think pith and substance, there's different ways that you could describe it, but I think it's trying to figure out, like, at the heart, in its essence, in its soul, what is this thing doing, right? Is this provincial? Is it federal? Is this Section 91? Is this Section 92 of the Constitution Act of 1867, right? And there's always this concern about, are you basically trying to put lipstick on a pig, right? Are you trying to dress up, something that's supposed to look like it's federal law, but it's actually provincial law, or vice versa? And courts are really trying to adjudicate whether or not, you know, there's actually lipstick that's being put on the pig or not.
So given that in this case, the federal government is basically relying on one primary justification for the fact that they have jurisdiction, which is this, you know, POG, as we call it, power, and specifically the national concern branch of the POG test, which may put some people to sleep. But there is kind of an issue at the center of this, which is the federal government has kind of a risky litigation strategy here, right? They're just relying on this one notoriously fickle part of the Constitution to justify this large scheme. I'm wondering if either of you have a thought on what that could potentially mean for the outcome of this case.
So I think that the reason that we're in this conundrum is that the framers of the Constitution in 1867 weren't thinking about the environment as a goal or as an interest, right? So you look to 91 and 92 of the Constitution Act, and you can't locate the environment anywhere, right? So you're left in this situation of having to say, okay, well, I guess we go to POG, this kind of constitutional grab bag, right? National concern. And, you know, I think it's a risky strategy, but I think it'll probably be an effective strategy given how complex the environment is, how it's very difficult to say an environmental issue stops at borders that were marked by colonial framers of the Constitution years ago. So I think it's a strong argument, but I agree with you that, you know, when you're thinking about constitutional strategy, there's always a risk that if you try to hang your hat in one particular area and that proves unsuccessful, you may have lost the case.
Now, this is obviously a really complicated issue. So for those interested to learn more about the carbon tax reference, we actually did a whole podcast on it. So check out episode 4 of the Law Review podcast, wherever you find your podcasts. So those were all the cases that we discussed during the speaker series yesterday. This might seem like a stretch, but the whole time that I was listening to the event, all I could think about was the kind of major question that I think a lot of these cases point to, which is our Constitution elastic enough to meet kind of these novel, pressing, you know, climate change, the internet, like, is our Constitution elastic enough to really meaningfully and thoughtfully confront these really important issues? And if yes, then also are our judges brave enough and capable enough of extending it to meet those needs?
Well, I could say, I guess my initial view or the short answer to me is yes, the Constitution is flexible enough to adapt to changing circumstances. We talk about that a lot, or the jurisprudence talks about that a lot, this idea that the way we understand constitutional rights, constitutional frameworks, of course, is rooted in the origins of these documents and in constitutional rules, but that we also have a document that is flexible, that can adapt and can meet current realities. I think what that means, though, in practice, is that judges have an enormous responsibility to articulate modern conceptions of constitutional rights and constitutional frameworks. And I think that means that it really matters who the judges are. And we've had the debate about diversity, the importance of the diversity of judges, the fact that we've never had an Indigenous justice on the Supreme Court of Canada. And I think these things really go together. When you have a flexible constitution that depends to a significant extent on judges articulating putting the flesh on the bones of the Constitution, it means that the people matter. And there is still, I would say, a diversity problem on our highest court that does impact on the court's ability to do this.
Okay, so amazing. Thank you so much, Professor McDonnell and Kirkup. Thank you for walking us through these really complicated cases. Do either of you have anything that you want to plug before you go?
Yeah, juste pour dire que nous allons avoir un deuxième événement en fin d'octobre qui va porter sur les causes venant du Québec, de droit civil et des causes particulièrement pertinentes au Québec. Alors, on vous invite de venir le 30 octobre de 11h30 le matin jusqu'à 13h dans la salle 302 pour en entendre plus. And also, we have some other very exciting upcoming events for our new Public Law Center. Later in November, we're going to be hosting a panel on the use of the courts to advance language rights, framed around recent litigation that's been initiated by our professor, François Larocque, and Senator Serge Joyal. So that's also something to watch out for, as well as a book launch coming at the end of, close to the end of November, which will be hosted by Professor Kirkup, featuring Adelina Iftien. She has a new book on aging prisoners out and the prison law issues around aging prisoners. And so that's also something to watch for.
Amazing. Thank you. And like the Supreme Court, you both have Twitters. So if people are interested, they can go follow you there.
So that's all from us. Thank you so much for listening. On espère que vous avez aimé ce balado. And be sure to stay tuned as we hope to publish more podcasts as the year goes on.
If you have any feedback about this podcast or want to learn more about the review, please visit our website at aldeo-olr.org.